Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM-LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. And we are proud to say that this is actually the one-year anniversary program for Radio In Vivo, and we look forward to another good year. And we welcome your comments or questions via email at radioinvivo@earthlink.net. And there's a website for the show, and that is at home.earthlink.net/tilde Radio In Vivo. You can access all of our past programs on that website, and it's getting to be quite an archive on a wide variety of topics, so please do check it out. And we're also available as a podcast on iTunes, and all you have to do is go to the iTunes site, hit Browse Podcasts, enter Radio In Vivo, and you can subscribe. And, of course, we've always had podcasts available on the station's website as well. And let's see, this coming Saturday, January 20th, I wanted to let you know that there's going to be a very exciting conference in Chapel Hill called the North Carolina Science Blogging Conference. And it's going to bring together bloggers and scientists and educators and writers and journalists like me who want to learn more about this new communications medium. And if you are interested, the conference is going to be from 8:30 to 5 p.m. at Murphy Hall on the UNC campus, which is near the Wilson Library. And they're looking at about 160 people coming to the event from across North Carolina and the country, so it should be pretty cool. And I also want to mention that Radio In Vivo and WCOM have benefited from the support of the multi-talented Claudio Oswald Niedvarok. Claudio is a master storyteller and a performing poet and author. He is available for bookings, so please check his website out at www.claudioarts.com. And I would like to remind you that this all-volunteer community radio station literally survives on your donations, so please consider making a tax-deductible contribution. It's easy to do that at the station's website, which is communityradio.coop. All you have to do is hit the Donate Now button, and you can make a secure donation by filling out the form. And last but not least, by way of introduction today, and perhaps most importantly, WCOM now has opportunities for local businesses to underwrite a show on Carrboro Chapel Hill's all-volunteer, listener-supported community radio station. And because there is no commercial clutter, your message will always stand out. To find out more, please email underwriting@communityradio.coop or leave a message at 919-929-9601 weekdays between the hours of 12 and 5 p.m. We certainly hope you'll consider taking advantage of this very cost-effective method of getting your message out and supporting this radio station. Well, this week on Radio In Vivo, we come to the end of a series of programs we've been doing with Triangle scientists who are involved in research on various aspects of human metabolism. We've looked at basic biomolecular research, at metabolomics, and at eating disorders. And this week, we're going to hear about one of the negative outcomes when metabolism, of course, goes awry, obesity. I think everyone is well aware by now that obesity is a major public health crisis facing both our nation and the entire world, and that obesity among our children and youth is an even more profoundly disturbing crisis. Joining us this week to talk about obesity, the science behind it, and the research that's going on to find effective interventions and preventions is Dr. Barry Popkin from the UNC School of Public Health. It's safe to say, I think, that Barry is one of our leading experts on obesity, and he has a very wide-ranging research agenda in the field, both here in the U.S. and internationally. Barry has a Ph.D. in economics and is a professor of nutrition at UNC Chapel Hill. Among several other positions, he is the director of the Interdisciplinary Center for Obesity at UNC, a program we'll discuss in detail. Barry, it's a pleasure to welcome you to Radio In Vivo.
Thank you very much.
I often like to start these conversations by defining some terms. In this case, I think we all know what obesity is. But obesity and being overweight clearly aren't the same thing. What are their current definitions?
For an adult, being overweight is a lesser weight for your same height than obesity. When we define obesity in statistical terms, we measure it in terms of weight in kilograms over height in meters squared. And we say that if a BMI, a body mass index, is 25, mm-hmm. you're and above, you're overweight. And if we say it's over 30, you're obese. Now, that has different meaning for different people.
Sure.
If you're a Hispanic or an Asian, your BMI might be 22, and you might have as much fat around your heart or liver as a white person with a BMI of 27 or 28. So you may be more likely to have diabetes with a BMI of 23 or 24 if you're Hispanic or Asian, than or stroke or hypertension, than you would if you're white with a higher level. And so the standards are really meant to not indicate who is completely at risk, but to give us a population sense of patterns and trends. And this is for an adult. A child would, if you use the same standard of BMI, would have a much lower BMI threshold to be overweight as they get younger and younger and they have less fat on their body.
Sure.
So we have an age and gender and your age and months standard for boys and girls from adolescence onward, and we have the same all the way back to 2-year-olds, 1-year-olds for what we consider as overweight.
And this is standards that have been well refined in the last many years. Right.
And to be honest, if you're overweight, you have lots of health costs. Your likelihood of having diabetes increases 4 to 5-fold over someone who has a normal weight in a lower level. And so to say that overweight is not a problem is really, it's not as serious a problem. If you have a BMI over 30 and you're what we call obese, if you're Hispanic or Asian, or even if you're white, you're beginning to have very much more likelihood of serious medical complications. It's not absolute that you'll have that.
Mm-hmm.
And what's unique is in the U.S., we have many, many people with a BMI over 40. We actually probably have 10 to 15% with a BMI over 40. And that's what makes us different than the rest of the world.
I see.
That we have much more very severe, serious overweight.
I see.
Obesity.
Well, and you touched on it, and I'd like to get you to elaborate just a little bit on the potential outcomes of these problems in terms of morbidity and mortality due to obesity, and include children as well.
Okay. Well, let's start with adolescents in this country. We are starting to get preschoolers and certainly school-age children, 6 to 10, with overweight. And by the time they're adolescents, they've often had it for quite some time. And we're beginning to see overweight children with some, what we call type 2 diabetes. This is the kind of diabetes that 30 years ago only occurred in adults over 50. Mm-hmm. And has slowly, as overweight, it's caused mainly by inactivity and overweight status. And those are the two major causes. There is a genetic component as well for some people. But with those two causes, we're starting to see several percent, 2 to 6% of adolescents having diabetes. In fact, in the Triangle, there was a recent newspaper article. One doctor who works in ER rooms has seen several children, adolescents, 12, 14, 16, dying from diabetes in the emergency room. So it's become a big problem. It's particularly a problem because if you're between 10 and 30 and getting diabetes, by the time you're 40 and 50, if not already in your 30s, you're going to start losing toes and limbs from it.
Sure.
Uncontrolled diabetes is very deadly. It doesn't kill you. It debilitates you.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes you very sick. And if you don't monitor it daily, and keep your blood sugar at a certain constant level, the effects on the body through the circulation problems and other things really becomes deadly very quickly.
I see. I know that this problem first came to light, to me at least, a couple of years ago at a conference that I heard you speak at in Washington, D.C., the Environmental Solutions to Childhood Obesity Conference. And the thing that that struck me there, and you've certainly touched on it being such a red flag, is that there were many clinicians speaking at that meeting who talked about being very shocked by the fact that they were starting to see type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular issues due to overweight and obesity in very young children, and that was something that they had never seen before in their clinical practices.
Right, right. But that's the tip of the iceberg, because beneath those diseases are all the metabolic risks occurring in a fairly large proportion of adolescents already. But let's move on to talk about adults and what overweight means. One of the key things to think about is smoking kills, obesity debilitates. You die earlier if you're very overweight, but you live for a very long time in a fairly sick condition. Mm-hmm. Meaning by that, you go to the hospital more often, you have to retire earlier, the absenteeism at work is around 20 to 40% higher than a normal weight person, and you become debilitated and physically disabled much younger. So the biggest concerns we have are the increased nursing home needs, the increased medical needs. The cost of insulin is astronomical. And if you think that 20-25% of Americans are going to be diabetic or are diabetic, and you think of the daily cost, let alone monthly and annual costs, it's really very high. Mm-hmm. So that we know that in terms of economic costs, a good portion of our healthcare expenses in this country and in Europe and emerging in other countries is caused by inactivity and poor diets that lead to overweight and then to all these other health problems.
Sure. Well, that you anticipated my next question about the overall economic impact of obesity and overweight. Yeah. Has anyone documented that at
yeah,
this point?
Yeah, but let me go another step.
Sure.
On the health costs. It used to be in the past we thought that the major causes of the 9 or 10 leading cancers were smoking for lung cancer and poor diet and some other things for others. We are going to have a major review that's published in a year which will tell us that for 9 of the top 10 cancers, either obesity and is the cause, the major preventable cause.
9 of the top 10.
Yeah, so that we will now learn that it's not just heart disease, but from a lot of new research that's come out in the last half decade, that it's inactivity and poor diets and overweight. And so we're talking about all the major chronic diseases. And I mean from issues like gallbladders, to sleep apnea, mm-hmm. to every kind of heart disease problem you have, to osteoarthritis in particular, to a number of cancers, postmenopausal, breast cancer, and so forth. Really, overweight is a major cause. And in contrast, cutting your weight, increasing your activity pattern, eating better, will prevent or will remove. So, but let's now come to your question about economic costs.
Okay.
In our country, there are many, many different studies on this. I've been involved with one with a group of economists at the Research Triangle Institute who are connected with our obesity center. And we saw that it's about double to triple the economic costs of overweight and obesity over smoking. And it's not, but as big as the costs are in medical care, equally big are the costs in lost work.
Right, right.
And that's what's really of concern, because as 10, 20% of our children become diabetic and other things, we're going to see a new generation which is really going to be very unattractive in the employment in the workplace. You hear about employers talking about a penalty against people who are overweight. Well, they do. you're very unlikely to be hired, much less likely, we know from lots of studies, mm-hmm. if you're overweight or obese. So the problems get multiplied throughout life.
I see. That's fascinating. Barry, in terms of the physiology involved, have we learned a significant amount about obesity over the past several years? And is this new knowledge contributing to efforts to combat the problem?
Well, yes and no. There's lots of talk about finding the magic gene
right.
that might, interacting with food or activity, be the cause that we can find some pill or something. But mm-hmm. thus far, we have no medication that does more than help mitigate in a very small way the overweight problems. One of the complexities is that obesity is really a hormonal disease, and the hormones are very basic to regulating our cardiovascular systems, our brain, many, many aspects, so that it's very, very difficult to find a drug that can work effectively without having major side effects.
Mm-hmm. And so, certainly the pharmaceutical companies are falling all over themselves.
They're trying. Everybody's trying for the magic bullet.
It would be the holy grail for them, I'm sure.
That's right. That's right. It would make it, as it did. If you may remember 5 or 10 years ago when we had something called Fen-Phen, where they combined two drugs, that people lost an enormous amount of weight. They also were almost completely likely, if they really lost all that weight, to have heart disease.
Right.
And so it was a holy grail for a year, and doctors of every sort, most of whom were not necessarily equipped, were providing these pills to everyone. The medication combination hadn't been certified by the FDA mm-hmm. as to be used, but they were using it, and we all of a sudden got a large number, hundreds of people with major heart disease, many of whom died.
Sure.
So that's the problem. We are learning a lot about fat cells in other ways, and unfortunately they're not good. We're finding that the fat cells are very active, and metabolically they produce lots of things and do lots of different things that in themselves help to produce disease and
right.
aren't positive.
I had Dr. Sheila Collins from CIIT on several weeks ago as part of this kind of series, and that's very much what her work is focused on and has shown.
Right. So I don't need to talk about some of that. We're certainly learning more about potential causes and interplays. We're learning that on the one hand, if you're overweight, you're more likely to have inflammation. The overweight status may partly cause it. We also are learning that your immune status gets compromised when you're overweight. And we're beginning to think from work that colleagues of mine and others are doing that many of the vaccinations we're using won't work for overweight people, so that we are going to have to do a lot more work on that side too, and that's another big negative issue. So there are constantly new work and new findings coming out on the basic science side mm-hmm. that tell us a lot about causes and consequences of the problem, but that doesn't solve the problem.
Right, sure.
And that doesn't prevent it.
Mm-hmm.
And there we need to move to the broader environment that we live in, and we need to move to find ways to get people moving more and eating in a more healthful manner, and that's the only solution.
And that's ultimately always what it really mm-hmm. comes back to, that there's no easy way out. It's diet and exercise.
Well, right? People are still constantly, and if you saw all the quack supplements that come out every month that say, do this and you'll lose weight, people do it, they make a fortune, nothing happens, or there are negative effects from some of them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we really don't have yet a pill solution or a supplement solution.
I see. Barry, I want to focus for just a few minutes on obesity in children and youth, as we've already touched on to a certain extent. You know, we've talked about the alarming trends and this crisis, and I mentioned that meeting that we both attended a couple of years ago, and at that meeting there were presentations about literally dozens of very ambitious intervention programs that were going on all over the country. And I know part of your portfolio is to evaluate programs like that. And in your estimation at this point, Are we starting to get a handle on what seems to be working in terms of intervention and what isn't?
In very minor ways, yes. We certainly know how we can help people lose weight. We don't know how we can help them keep it off for 20 or 50 years. We're getting some clues. Mm-hmm. That's a treatment side. For the prevention side, we are finding more and more smaller, intense interventions that may work in one group or another. But in a large population sense, it's very, very difficult for an intervention to offset the money of big food and big inactivity. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is if the government spends $1 million on an intervention project and Coke or Pepsi or some other food company are spending $1 billion in advertising or many hundreds of millions, mm-hmm. We can't offset that environment. You can't offset the environment where every place you turn you see a vending machine selling. You see commercials every place. Now they're having them in the turnstiles of the New York subways, and wherever you turn, you're finding advertisements.
Even on eggs.
And
now.
That's right. Then the new CBS advertising on eggs. And so that amount of money is there to say eat. Mm-hmm. And it's not eating vegetables or fruit or drink water. It could be to drink water because they make money from that, but it's eating typically energy dense, unhealthier foods. It's eating the higher profit and drinking the higher profit items, and we can't offset that. It's not any different than smoking. In the smoking area, as long as we let big tobacco advertise and sell at subsidized rates their tobacco, we really couldn't offset the smoking. It was taxation and regulations of advertising and public pressure that helped create the first big declines. And then it accelerated as people learned more and more about the cost of it and society began to move against it. And I don't really think that we'll offset big sugar, Coke and Pepsi and all the others out there, without the same kinds of taxation and regulation of advertising. Children today on the internet, and on their cell phones and on their TV when they watch it, they're inundated every half an hour with 10 to 15 minutes of commercials saying, drink this, eat that, this is good for you, you'll be fatter, you'll be stronger, you'll be this or that. None of it's correct,
right?
But to sell the product. And we have to take action at some level. We may not be ready as a society to do that yet.
Do you see some encouraging trends in that arena, though? I mean, it seems like there are many schools that are making their lunches healthier and banning junk food from the vending areas.
We've been very successful. In our state is one of the leaders that's saying in elementary and middle schools, no more vending machines at certain times, no more selling junk foods. We haven't been very successful yet at creating healthy eating in the cafeterias and getting children to eat healthy. It has to start with the home. It has to start at age one. And you can't all of a sudden tell a high school to change and get the kids to change when they've had 15 years of eating a different way. But we're starting, and it's all important. But in talking to a set of legislators, North Carolina has a very concerned group about this problem. They know we can't do certain things today that in 5 years the public will be willing for us to tax Coke and Pepsi because the problems will be that much greater for their children. But today we're not quite ready to do that. But we certainly have done what we can to encourage by having the schools. The next step will be to do the same in the high schools, and we haven't done that.
I see.
We politically, it's been very difficult. And so we have removed junk soft drinks and fruit drinks, and even juice is not healthy the way we consume it in this country. Mm-hmm. We used to think of it as God in our country, and it was just like apple pie, orange juice in the morning. But we've realized, and nutritionists have realized, there's as many calories in orange juice, and in studying it, there's very little nutritional benefit. Having an orange a week will give you much more than having that little bit of orange juice every day. And that orange juice is very high calorie. It's a Coke.
Well, that brings us right to an issue that I know is one that you study specifically, and that is beverages, which are kind of the unseen culprit in much of the obesity we're seeing today.
Right.
Could you tell us about your recent studies in that area?
Yes. I headed a national panel made up of really a set of eminent scholars, Walt Willett, George Bray, Ben Caballero, Balls Frey, and Lawrence Armstrong, each a scholar in different aspects of beverage intake. We did this because we've been focused so much on food and we've so ignored the beverages in society. Some of that's on purpose. Some of that's been because of funding and pressure by the beverage industries and big sugar. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that beverages have a very different effect on our body than does food. And essentially what I mean is if you drink a Coke or you drink a glass of milk or you drink a beer, you don't cut the food you drink at your next meal. Whereas if I consume a candy bar, I do reduce my food. So that we know that if we feed somebody a beverage, be it water or a caloric beverage, it doesn't change the food they take in.
I see.
Now, that would be fine, except that if you think that for the first, if we think of mankind starting 200,000 years ago with the first monkeys and proceeding forward in an evolutionary sense till we finally have 50, 100,000 years ago Homo sapiens and forward, all we consumed was water except for breast milk for the baby. And after the age of 2 or 3 or 4, water was all we ever consumed. So we developed biologically so that we didn't reduce our food intake when we consumed water. That would have been really dangerous. We wouldn't have survived. So that you all of a sudden then develop 100 years ago and in the last 50 years really get promotion of caloric beverages. We consume very little. There were times we consumed a lot of alcohol up and down in society, but never that many calories over a day. And so we went from consuming very few calories to 100 calories a day to 200 to 450 calories a day today for the average adult, and the same for the average teen from soft drinks, mm-hmm, and fruit, mm-hmm, drinks and alcohol and juice and milk. And all of a sudden, we have increased in the last 20 to 25 years among adults, 230 calories a day from beverages. Two-thirds of that soft drinks and fruit drinks, one-third is alcohol. We are consuming more alcohol as well. Now, that would all be good and dandy if we cut our food intake down, but if we don't, which is what we know doesn't occur, that's pure extra calories added to our body.
So it really is the unseen culprit.
It is one of the unseen culprits. Yeah. It's not the only unseen culprit. Mm-hmm. We add sugar to lots of other foods. We're adding a lot of hidden fats and other things.
Sure.
But I would say that half to two-thirds of the energy increase in America has come from these beverages.
And
the rest is salty snacks and all these extra meals we're consuming and so on. But so that if everybody cut out, their went from Coke to Diet Coke, or went had one less beer or one less glass of wine,
drink your coffee black,
right, or had a little bit of sugar in the coffee rather than a 600 calorie super latte whatever they have, or had a smoothie that didn't have all the calories in it and only had a little bit of fruit and ice water instead of the 600 to 800 calorie smoothies that we eat in general, consume in general, we would cut. And I've had many testimonials emailed to me because of the work of our beverage panel, and when I've been on national talk shows and other things, people saying, I've lost 30 pounds because I just stopped my Mountain Dew that I was consuming when I worked, and I was consuming 4 to 8 of them a day.
Sure,
that's a lot of weight.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what I know that one of the things you have talked about is kind of a pecking order in terms of beverages and consumption.
Right.
Could you give our listeners a little bit of that?
And what we tried to do was give people a sense of what are good and bad beverages and what proportions. For instance, milk is really important if we consume skim milk or 1% milk. We don't need the saturated fat. It does us no good that comes from 2% in whole milk. And it's actually a lot of calories, too. But it's bad calories that affect our heart later. So, and cancer and other things now we know. So what milk is not top of our order, but it's very important. The top of our order is water. You could, with a healthy diet, consume 100% water during the day, and that would be really good for you. Second on the line would be diet beverages after tea and coffee. Tea and coffee are really actually healthful, particularly coffee. We know it has some benefits for diabetes and gallstones and other things.
I am so glad to hear you say that.
But unsugared, unsweetened, or with a little bit. If you have one teaspoon of sugar, it's not going
to
do much. But if you put a lot of sugar in it.
I take it black.
Right. If you put a lot of sugar in, it's not good for you. So tea and coffee. Sure. Now, there's a caffeine problem. Caffeine is beneficial if you consume, let's say, between 100 and 300 milligrams a day. But as you move over toward the higher end, it gets detrimental, and it can have real perverse effects, which is the problem we're experiencing with some of the new Red Bulls and other high-caffeine drinks. But so 4 cups of coffee or 8 cups of tea would be fine. That's essentially 32 ounces of coffee or 64 of tea would give you enough caffeine, but not too much. But consuming more than that can actually have detrimental health effects. Okay. Then we move to milk and diet beverages. Milk, when it's skim and 1%, is really healthful in limited amounts. We think children should have a couple glasses a day because most kids don't have the balanced diet that could allow them to not need milk. Mm-hmm. And so milk provides a lot of nutrients that we can't get otherwise. For adults, maybe a glass a day would provide, again, just because we have too many people not consuming a healthy mix pattern of diet.
In terms of getting calcium.
Soy milk would also do the same, especially if it's low-fat soy milk. Mm-hmm. Just the same issues. Then we move to the caloric beverages. We really want people not to consume whole milk, cream. We want people to have no more than a half a cup, a glass, 4 ounces a day of a juice if it's a fruit juice, because they're so high in calories and give such a minimal amount of nutritional benefits. Vegetable juices have more nutritional benefits, but they have a lot of salt in them. And they haven't been able to develop vegetable juices that are low salt yet.
I see.
And tasty. So that's a little bit of a problem for people who are concerned with their salt intake. Alcohol in moderation. A glass for a woman a day, 2 glasses for men is really fine and healthy. Mm-hmm. You can be a teetotaler and be fine also, but there are health benefits with a minimal amount of alcohol.
Right.
Glass
of wine a day.
Yeah, or two for a man and one for a woman. Women are more sensitive to the alcohol, and it has a bigger metabolic effect on them, so a little bit less. But perfectly fine, won't have you read high on your blood alcohol tests and so forth. So, and then we move to the deadly poisons. The fruit juices, the soft drinks, the fruit drinks, the soft drinks, the high calorie Red Bulls, and all these beverages out there which are very high calorie, the super lattes with all sorts of cream and sugars and flavorings that are caloric in them, and all of those high calorie beverages. Frappuccino that's 100 or 200 calories for very little beverage. They're all in the category of what we think are the beverages. If people could eliminate in their diet, they would be much healthier and they'd lose weight, or they certainly would stop gaining.
Sure, sure. Well,
it won't give them a license to eat more, but it will help them with their weight issues.
Well, that's excellent advice, and I think it's important to bring that out. And Barry, there's another study there that came out recently that I wanted to ask you about and maybe let you get on a slightly different soapbox. There was a review of 111 beverage studies published between 99 and 03 that showed that much of that research was funded by the beverage industry, and that the research was found to be 4 to 8 times more likely to yield health results favorable to companies if it was sponsored by the food industry than research with no corporate ties.
Right. I'm familiar with that study. I know the details on it. At first, it was a very carefully done study where the authors, the people who rated each article for their what the results came out to be interpreted as, for example, pro drink more milk, pro it's not bad to consume Coke, or some such thing with the different beverages, and the con side, which were they were bad for your health or they didn't lose weight or whatever it was. And that study fits something that I've been really quite concerned with in the beverage world. Big sugar, big juice, all of the big beverage companies have really put an enormous amount of money into trying to control the message, mm-hmm. and control Congress and control the federal government and control the legislation against them. For example, when each of the states in the country tried to get the vending machines and the Coke and the Pepsis out of the schools, the bottling companies in that area put a lot of money into trying to convince legislators not to do this.
Sure.
Pepsi pulled back. Coke has said they're going to pull back. They haven't really done it very much yet.
Mm-hmm.
And the beverage industry, those two in Schweppes said, we will not do this anymore. Well, it's still occurring, and it makes it hard for legislators to do what they think is right when they have money coming at them and people calling and they're in the enticements that come with that. So,
and they're building the new bleachers for them. And
right.
Like
and
that.
The lobbying and the money that goes into those sectors is huge. It's big business.
Mm-hmm.
If you think of the beverage industry, it's much bigger than tobacco industry was. And you think of all these different foods that we consume around it. So what they have done is some scientists even have patents that say, one scientist has a patent that says, if whenever you advertise drinking milk makes you lose weight, which has not been shown scientifically, but the milk industry is advertising that, that guy gets $1 for each time or more. For each exposure of the ads and so forth, he gets some money.
Mm-hmm.
And
gee, I wish I'd thought of that.
And that guy is one of the major scientists putting in all the studies saying milk is good for you.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to wonder. You have to have people who are impartial doing the research.
Mm-hmm.
And in our work with the beverage panel, we found that all the studies we looked at that were funded by the beverage industry were the same. And we excluded most of them in our thinking because they were all producing mixed messages. But then I've debated people who are funded by the sugar industry and the beverage industry. I debated one person at a national scientific meeting who had an earlier meeting funded by the beverage company to help him develop the arguments he would use against me when we talked about the pros and cons of these different beverages for health.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been to meetings where senior scientists have gotten up and berated people who have questioned something, and they were funded by the beverage company. I was at one where I was chairing the panel, and I had to say to this person who was kind of beating up on a young scholar who had done some studies to show that water, in drinking extra water, actually cut people's weight. And he was questioning that and all sorts of really rather ways that were unscientific and not very ethical. And I made him admit to the audience that his funding to come to that meeting, and much of his funding was coming from Coke.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he was on an institute that Coke had developed, a health institute, that was run by people like himself who were working for them. Now, this is a really good scientist, and other arenas has done very good work.
Sure.
But it's a problem we have.
Well, there's no question that, as you say, it's such a large campaign to control the message.
Absolutely. And whenever someone like myself, so we came out with our beverage panel, we had a press release in New York City. Within a day, there were 20 PR people funded by the Beverage Association calling up all the newspapers, questioning our work, trying to make sure that the association voice was heard in all these articles and so forth. It's just amazing how journalists get pressured constantly.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think of what the journalists are doing, it's quite amazing.
Absolutely. Well, it seems like the food industry in general and the beverage companies in particular, part of what they're up to these days is they have programs in place that are, at least on the surface, looking to change their product mix to make it healthier or encourage physical activity. They all seem to have PR-related programs.
They have huge PR-related activities, tiny programs. So,
yeah.
For example, the Clinton Foundation had all these beverage groups met with them, along with the American Heart Association, signed this agreement that they would say we would do all sorts of things to reduce beverage consumption for children and so forth. Well, you don't see them acting on what they've said. And there's no monitoring of. They never give money to the foundations to monitor and evaluate what they're doing, and they're not.
Mm-hmm.
And so the PR efforts are often far bigger than the programs. On the other hand, University of North Carolina gained. Gatorade gave money to the athletic department and the nutrition department at the University of North Carolina for them to create a number of prevention and intervention projects that were very good. Athletes going around getting kids to move more, a program to get kids to drink and eat differently.
Mm-hmm.
And so they do some things, but it's limited. For example, I'll go to a very interesting one, Sesame Street. If you watched it today, Cookie Monster only eats a cookie now and then. Every program talks about activity today and about consuming more fruits and vegetables and being healthier. They lost a number of sponsors. They got rid of them, actually, that were selling junk food. And they've had more difficulty getting sponsors to replace those. They did it, despite the cost to them, because they want to have a product they believe in.
Sure.
And that is not something that many newspapers mm-hmm. are going to do.
Mm-hmm.
That is not something that many radio or TV groups are going to do. And so it's a big issue.
Absolutely. My guest on Radio In Vivo this morning, and I've been remiss in reminding everyone because Barry's discussion has been so fascinating and provocative, is Dr. Barry Popkin from UNC. And Barry, I certainly want to hear and give you some time to discuss the various programs that you are involved with. Could you tell us first about the program that you direct at UNC, the Interdisciplinary Center
right.
for Obesity? What types of research activities are pursued there?
The University of North Carolina at first is really unique. Among most universities in the country, one of the few where people really work together across the campus. So we have people in the medical school, in the School of Public Health, and arts and sciences, and journalism, and nursing, and others that interface in a way you don't find it anywhere else. I remember when I went to interview for a job at Johns Hopkins, and I said, I want to work with people in that other department. They wouldn't even let me talk to them. They didn't want it, and I didn't go there. But so our center has 73 faculty who are involved in overweight and obesity-related research. But they're from 30 to 40 departments.
Mm-hmm.
They're from
mm-hmm.
every school on campus, allied health sciences, arts and sciences, journalism and mass communications, nursing, the medical school, the School of Public Health. It's quite phenomenal. The people interested in this topic. Some are bench scientists, we have journalists, we have urban planners, we have several people in our urban and regional planning department who are actively involved in trying to do things related to getting people to walk more.
Sure.
So it's across the campus. And it's been very wonderful because we've gotten and we've created all sorts of new collaborations out of it, getting people from mass communications and planning, working with people in public health and epidemiology and exercise science to try to promote ways to people, children, to move more or to work with pregnant women. And we've had people, and we've had people from Duke there involved, but people from nursing and psychiatry, working with people in public health and mass communications to help young preschoolers move more and eat better. Very, very interesting new interdisciplinary work. And we started the center with the belief that obesity was caused by too many different problems across society, and it would take a big solution and cross-cutting solutions to deal with the problem. You couldn't deal with the problem by staying in your box. And if that meant, if you're a physiologist, you worked on narrow things, but maybe related to tissue, or you were a diabetologist, you worked on something with endocrinology and some very basic kinds of things. And we felt we needed all these people to work together. We're doing work between the genetic side and the environmental side and how they might interact. We've got scientists who are doing some very interesting work looking at weight gain and showing how diet is more susceptible to increasing extra weight if you've got a certain genetic disposition over another. And these this is really the cutting edge of the new world and the needs we have. If we're going to have major solutions to problems, we need larger teams. And
well, that seems to be the trend in so many areas of science these
but
days.
We've been lucky at Chapel Hill to have an environment and a campus leadership that fosters that, and mm-hmm. it's been easy to do, which is really why I've stayed in Chapel Hill. I love the town, but it's the campus really allows you to work this way. In all my projects, I have people from arts and sciences, public health, medical schools working together. It's wonderful.
That sounds great. Well, Barry, I know that you also direct a program that I want to hear about with an international focus called the Nutrition Transition Program. It's a really interesting effort to identify and characterize large-scale trends in nutrition. And can you tell us about that and tell us what is the nutrition transition?
Well, the nutrition transition is really the stages of diet and activity and body composition that we've gone through over time and the factors behind that. And I created this kind of theory and way of looking at things to help make it easier to understand the shifts going on not only in our country but around the world in diet and activity. We're in a world today where there are three low-income countries that have as much overweight and obesity as we do: Egypt, South Africa, and Mexico. Mm-hmm. And there mm-hmm. are high-income countries that have the same level. We think we're unique. We're not unique.
Right.
And so part of it is understanding some of these global dynamics, but a lot of it is understanding why. I'm working in China on food price issues and trying to work with the Chinese government and others to work out solutions that will deal with some of the problems. A quarter of Chinese adults are overweight. That's over 300 to 400 million adults in China, and the rate of increase is huge, very rapid.
Yeah.
So we have a world where we have 1.6 billion overweight, and in a couple of years we'll have 2 billion overweight and obese adults and children. And we need to find bigger solutions. We need to find regulations, price changes, large-scale education efforts that will work. And that's a lot of what my research program. I have large surveys going on in a number of countries. China, I've been following 16,000 to 20,000 people every couple of years with very intense surveys where we survey them for 30, 40 hours, learn how they eat, how they move, what their income is, what they're doing, how they spend their time, trying to understand how the community factors, prices, and other things affect them. And we've been doing that for 17 years now, doing the same in Russia for 15 years, doing work with colleagues in Brazil and other countries. We also have large-scale studies in this country. Carolina Population Center at the University of North Carolina started something called the National Study of Longitudinal Study of Adolescent Health. We're following 20,000 adolescents, and our interests, my colleagues and I, are on the physical environment and economic environment and how it affects what recreation options you have, your neighborhoods, how what they're like, and in turn how that affects how you move, whether you walk or drive a car, what you eat, and so forth. And so my U.S. effort is very much looking, again, at environmental solutions, prices, crime.
Access to healthy foods.
Access to healthy foods, access to healthy options for recreation, and so forth, that allow people to live healthier lives.
So it's very interesting to hear you talk about that it's really a worldwide trend towards overweight and obesity, and that's really shocking. And is that where the nutrition transition is? That as these countries, you know, you mentioned China, Russia, Brazil, and I'm sure several others you're looking at, these are emerging, developing countries.
These are all
lifestyles
yes.
are changing. I'm
right,
sure.
And what I look at is I go to a village in Chiapas, Mexico, and 5 years that had no electricity and no roads. 5 years later, they have electricity and roads, and all of a sudden, I see all the tiendas full of soft drinks. I see little 3-year-olds walking down the street with potato chips, and I understand that much more on the human level what I'm trying to study and understand how we can control. And Mexico in 1990 had almost no overweight, a few percent. Today, 71% of Mexican adult women and 65% of adult men are overweight or obese. They have a diabetes rate in Mexico equal to what we had 20 years ago. And in 10 years, they will have a diabetes rate higher than us.
Wow.
And this is going from no place. Mexico consumes more Coke and Pepsi than we do. They are the largest soft drink consuming country in the world.
Is that right?
We're not the only one out there. Now, it's not just big Coke and Pepsi are the problem, or McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Food. Mm-hmm. They may be important in some countries, but there have been big shifts in the way people eat every place. Walmarts are everywhere in the world, and the equivalents.
Do people in developing areas see that kind of dietary availability as a measure of their own success?
Well, absolutely correct that if I went to Africa, people still desire to be overweight. It's changing in South Africa, where overweight has become so prevalent and the health costs are becoming more understood by everybody. But in general, if you go around countries that were poor, they wanted to be heavier. They wanted to have more meat. It's a sign of prosperity. Whereas in our country today, it's now looked at as a sign of poor health, and it's not so attractive. But those body image changes can become perverse, of course. And you talked to somebody on eating disorders that went to the other extreme and talked about thinness also having its negative side when it's too extreme. But there's an in-between point. And unfortunately, what's happened is while countries have become higher income and have developed in the last 20 years, food prices have become cheaper. The world has made it easy for people everywhere to eat and live the way we do at much cheaper and lower income levels, so that what we eat, people can eat elsewhere. I remember my son went to work to college in Beijing, China, 2 years ago for his junior year abroad. And he emailed me and said, I can buy everything you can buy. There's a Carrefour, which is the French Walmart chain. Quarter of a mile away, I can walk there and get the same candy bars and anything I could get here, the same junk food. That's becoming available to the globe. And as it becomes available, and as the media becomes and people think that's the good thing to live and eat with, unless we change that and control their accesses or change the prices, those are all cheaper products. Sugar is very cheap globally. It's subsidized globally.
Sure.
A lot of these high-fat products are very cheap because we've done things to subsidize them. So we need to find ways to make it cheaper to eat healthy and more expensive to eat unhealthy, and we need to find ways to encourage people to move, and it's going to be very difficult because we're fighting against history from the time of the fire in the wheel. We wanted to find ways to move less. The TV clicker, the garage door opener, the escalator, the elevator. Mm-hmm. You can think the microwave, the Cuisinart, going into a grocery store and buying processed food.
Sure.
In 1950, people spent 2 hours a day preparing food. They spend 10 to 20 minutes a day today. We move less.
Right.
We've got to find ways to change that.
Well, you have very much an uphill battle ahead of you.
I think
and
so.
And plenty left to do.
Yes.
Well, Barry, we're getting ready to close out our hour already. I certainly wanted to give you the opportunity. If there's one message that you would like to get out to our listening audience today about how to deal with overweight and obesity in their own daily lives, whether it's for themselves or their children, what would that be?
The simplest would be get the caloric beverages out of your life. The harder one that I even have trouble with would be get the sugar out of your life.
Mm-hmm.
That's a tough one.
It is indeed, isn't it? And is that particularly important with as I say,
from
children?
From the don't have it in the house. If parents are role models and can drink, children will drink. It's the parents' responsibility.
Absolutely. Well, Barry, thank you so much for taking the time to share your expertise, which is considerable, with us today on Radio In Vivo. And best of luck in your efforts to both understand and combat obesity and overweight.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
And next week on Radio In Vivo, we're going to be paying a visit to the North Carolina State University School of Veterinary Medicine with my guest, Dr. Greg Dean. We will learn all about the cutting-edge research that is going on at the vet school, including Dr. Dean's work on feline immunodeficiency as a model for the human version, which is, of course, HIV. It should be a fascinating conversation, so I hope you will join us. This is Ernie Hood for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Carrboro and Chapel Hill. If you enjoy the program, please do make an effort to support the station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. See you next week.